You know, there's this specific object that essentially serves as the unofficial mascot of post-surgical recovery.
Oh, yeah.
If you've ever visited a relative in the hospital after a major operation, or if you've been the patient yourself, you've definitely seen it sitting on the bedside table.
I know exactly what you're picturing. It's that clear plastic device, usually with a corrugated blue tube attached to it. And it's got either these colorful little balls floating in chambers or like a piston with measurement lines on the side.
Yeah, and honestly, it looks like a toy.
It really does.
It looks like something you'd pick up at a dollar store to distract a toddler. But looking through the clinical practice guidelines and the respiratory care documentation we have for this deep dive, that piece of plastic is doing some extraordinarily heavy lifting.
It is.
Right.
We are talking about the incentive spirometer. And you're right, the appearance is entirely deceptive. It looks low tech, but it is the primary line of defense against some very high stakes complications. I mean, we're talking about the difference between a standard discharge and developing life-threatening pneumonia.
And that is the mission for this deep dive. We're going to decode what this device actually does because it is definitely not what most people assume.
Not at all.
And we're going to unpack the physiology of why our lungs basically try to shut down after surgery. We're basing this on clinical protocols and product insights, specifically looking at the mechanics of sustained maximal inspiration.
Which is a bit of a mouthful of a term,
Definitely.
but it's the key concept here. It sounds academic, but for anyone in a hospital bed, it's the most important concept in the world.
So let's start with the misconception, because I think if you polled 10 people in a hospital waiting room and asked, what is that plastic machine for?
Nine of them would say, oh, it pumps oxygen into your lungs.
Exactly.
Absolutely. That is the number one myth. And it makes sense why people think that, right? Medical devices usually do things to you.
Right. IVs put fluids in, ventilators push air in.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But an incentive spirometer is fundamentally different. It is not a passive delivery system. It doesn't push anything into you at all.
It's actually the opposite mechanism.
Completely opposite. It is a resistance training device. It's basically a gym for your diaphragm.
A lung gym.
Yeah, a lung gym. The technical definition is that it's a tool to encourage that sustained maximal inspiration, or SMI. It forces you to generate the negative pressure required to pull air in.
So it's not a ventilator, it's a coach. It's a visual biofeedback tool.
Exactly. It visualizes your breath.
Yeah.
And to understand why that matters, we really have to look at the why.
Right.
Why is this necessary specifically after surgery? Because normally we breathe automatically. I don't need a plastic tube to tell me to breathe while I'm sitting here talking to you.
Right. But surgery changes the biological rules. Reading through the material, it seems like a perfect storm of factors hits the lungs the very moment you go under.
It really is a perfect storm. First, you have the anesthesia itself. It suppresses the respiratory drive and completely relaxes the muscles.
Yeah.
Then you have the positioning. You are likely lying supine, so flat on your back, for hours. That allows the abdominal organs to shift upward, which physically compresses the diaphragm.
So you simply don't have the room to take a deep breath, even if you wanted to.
Correct. But the biggest factor, and the one that guidelines emphasize the most, kicks in after you wake up.
The pain.
And that is pain, yes.
Specifically for thoracic or abdominal surgeries, right?
Right. If you've had an incision across your abdomen, taking a deep breath hurts. It pulls on the incision. So the body engages a subconscious defense mechanism called splinting.
Splinting. I found this fascinating in the sources. It's like your body is trying to put a cast on your lungs.
That's a great way to put it. You automatically take short, shallow breaths to avoid moving the painful area.
Because it hurts.
Exactly. You stop sighing, you stop yawning, you essentially lock down your diaphragm to protect the injury site.
And that shallow breathing isn't just inefficient, it leads to a specific physiological collapse. The term in the source material is atelectasis.
Atelectasis. This is the real villain of our story.
Break that down for us. What is physically happening in the lungs during atelectasis? Because honestly, it sounds terrifying.
It is, but it's purely mechanical. Imagine your lungs are essentially a massive collection of millions of tiny balloons called alveoli.
Okay.
These are the sacs where the gas exchange actually happens. Oxygen in, carbon dioxide out. To stay inflated, they need a certain amount of regular deep expansion.
They need to be stretched.
Yes. When you enter that splinting mode, that shallow, rapid breathing, the air in those bottom balloons, the ones at the very base of the lung, gets absorbed into the blood, but no new air comes in to replace it.
Wow.
So the balloon deflates. The walls of the sac actually touch each other and stick shut.
And once they stick shut, simply taking a normal breath isn't enough to pop them back open, right?
Precisely. It takes significantly more pressure to reopen a collapsed balloon than it does to keep an inflated one full. It's like blowing up a brand new party balloon. You know that first breath is really hard.
Oh yeah, you turn purple trying to get it started.
That's the exact physics of it. Once the alveoli collapse, a normal, shallow breath just takes the path of least resistance.
It bypasses them.
Exactly. It goes to the parts of the lung that are already open. The collapsed parts stay collapsed.
So you have these collapsed sticky sacs at the bottom of your lungs, and the source material draws a direct line from that collapse straight to pneumonia.
It's a straight line. Collapsed lung tissue is wet. It traps secretions and mucus because this ciliary clearance.
The little hairs.
Right, the little hairs that sweep mucus up and out. They can't work in a collapsed airway. That trapped, warm, wet mucus is basically a petri dish for bacteria.
That's the ventilation perfusion mismatch I read about.
Correct. And that is how a successful surgery turns into a post-op infection. You fix the appendix, but the patient gets pneumonia because they didn't take a deep breath.
So enter the plastic toy. The incentive spirometer is designed to generate that specific popping pressure.
We call it transpulmonary pressure. The device is calibrated to force you to inhale deeply enough to create a pressure differential that physically pulls those sticky alveoli back open.
But here is where the design of the device is so clever. Because you could just tell a patient, hey, breathe deep. But the sources suggest that verbal instructions alone rarely work.
They don't work because deep is subjective. If you're in pain, a breath that feels deep to you might actually be only 30% of your capacity.
You're grading yourself on a curve.
Exactly. The device removes the curve. It's objective data.
It gamifies the physiology.
It does. Whether it's ball floating or a piston rising, it gives you a visual target. You can't lie to the piston.
Right.
If you don't engage the diaphragm, the piston doesn't move. It creates an accountability loop between the patient and their own recovery.
Let's talk about the technique, because this was surprising to me. I'll admit, if you handed me one of these without instructions, my instinct would be to just blow into it like I'm blowing out birthday candles.
And you would be in very good company. That is the single most common error patients make.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I've seen patients try to blow the balls up to the top, just turning red in the face. But remember the goal. We are trying to inflate the lungs, not empty them.
Right.
It is an inspiratory device. You have to suck the air in.
So mouthpiece in, seal your lips, and inhale. But the nuance here, and the guidelines are very specific about this, is the speed.
Yes.
It's not just about getting the air in, it's about how you get it in.
This is critical, the slow and steady rule.
Mm-hmm.
There is a tendency, especially if you're competitive, to want to snap that piston up to the top as fast as possible.
Just a sharp gasping breath.
Like a sniff, a high flow sniff.
Right.
The problem is, when you breathe like that, you are creating turbulent airflow. And more importantly, you are recruiting the wrong muscles.
The accessory muscles.
Yes. You're using the muscles in your neck and upper chest.
So you're bypassing the diaphragm entirely.
You are. And you aren't effectively aerating the bases of the lungs, which is exactly where the atelectasis is hiding. The source material emphasizes laminar flow.
Smooth flow.
Exactly. You want a slow, smooth, controlled drag of air that allows the air to distribute evenly and reach those distal areas.
Okay, so I'm inhaling slowly. I'm watching the piston rise. I hit my target volume. Now comes the part that sounds the hardest, the hold.
The inspiratory hold. This is the secret sauce. You need to hold that breath at peak inspiration for at least 3 to 5 seconds.
Why is the hold so important? If I've filled the lungs, haven't I done the job?
Not necessarily. Think about those sticky balloons again. It takes time for the pressure to equalize a chronic lung tissue. This is a concept called alveolar stabilization.
Okay.
If you just inhale and immediately exhale, you might pop the sac open for a millisecond, but it will just snap shut again immediately.
You need to keep it pressurized long enough to break the surface tension.
Exactly. It's like peeling Velcro apart.
Mm-hmm.
You need sustained force. You are giving the alveoli time to stabilize in the open position.
That makes total sense.
Without the hold, you're losing half the benefit of the exercise.
And doing all of this requires the right posture. I noticed the term high Fowler's position in the notes.
Yes, which is just clinical speak for sitting upright, ideally at 90 degrees.
So no slouching allowed.
Physics is entirely against you if you slouch. If you are slumped over or lying flat, your abdominal contents, your stomach, liver, intestines, they push up against the diaphragm.
Right.
You physically limit your lung capacity before you even start. You need gravity to help pull those organs down so the lungs have room to expand.
It's amazing how mechanical this all is. It's literally plumbing and physics.
It really is.
Now, looking at the devices themselves, we mentioned earlier there are two main types, volume-oriented and flow-oriented. Is there a functional difference in how they help you recover?
There is, and it comes down to what they measure.
Yeah.
Flow-oriented units are the ones with the three colorful balls in different chambers.
Okay.
They measure the speed of your inhalation, the flow rate. The goal is to lift the ball and keep it floating.
Those are the ones that look the most like toys.
They are. They're generally cheaper and simpler. But the downside is they focus more on effort control than actual capacity.
Oh, I see.
You could potentially cheat a flow device by inhaling fast but shallowly.
Whereas the volume-oriented ones...
Those usually use a piston or a bellows. They measure the total amount of air you inhaled. They give you a hard number in milliliters, like you inhaled 2,000 mLs.
So the volume unit gives you a hard metric.
Right. And in a clinical setting, volume-oriented units are generally preferred for structured protocols because they provide better data.
For the nurses to track.
Exactly. A nurse can track trends. Yesterday you were at 1,500. Today you're at 2,000. That is measurable progress.
That tracking is vital, but I want to circle back to the human factor. Because we can talk about physics and flow rates all day, but at the end of that tube is a person who just had major surgery and is likely miserable.
This is where the clinical ideal crashes into reality. You can have the best device in the world, but if the patient is in too much pain to use it, it's just a paperweight. Mm-hmm.
The source material mentions multimodal analgesia. That feels like a very clinical way of saying you have to treat the pain to treat the lungs.
That's exactly it. It's a partnership. If a patient is guarding their abdomen because of pain, they physically cannot perform a sustained maximal inspiration.
Right.
Pain management isn't just about comfort. It's an operational requirement for respiratory therapy.
So the pain meds actually facilitate the breathing exercises.
Correct. And we have to manage expectations. There is a massive psychological component here. Patients, especially the high achievers, often wake up and want to hit the healthy person target immediately.
They want to max out the machine on day one.
Exactly. They want to get the piston to the very top.
And when they can?
They get discouraged. Or worse, they strain and hurt themselves. The guidance is clear on this. Targets should be based on age, height, and gender. But the real goal is progression.
Just getting a little better each time.
We want to see you climb back to your baseline gradually.
It's rehabilitation, not a contest.
And it's an endurance event.
Yeah.
The recommendation isn't to just do this once a day. It's often recommended to do 10 breaths every single hour while you're awake.
Every hour. That essentially makes recovery a full-time job.
It is.
Yeah.
Because the force is trying to collapse your lungs, the lying down, the shallow breathing, those are constant.
Right.
You have to constantly fight back to keep those lights on and the alveoli.
Is there a risk of overdoing it, though? If 10 is good, is 20 better?
Not necessarily. Safety is generally high, but there is a real risk of hyperventilation.
Oh, sure.
If you sit there and pump 10 massive breaths back to back with no pause, you're going to wash out too much carbon dioxide. You'll get dizzy, lightheaded, maybe even feel tingling in your fingers.
So the advice is take a breath, hold, exhale, and then rest.
Yes. Treat it like a set of weightlifting. You need the rest interval between reps.
Let's zoom out to the hospital floor context. This device isn't just an isolated tool. It fits into this broader framework called ES.
ERS. Enhanced Recovery After Surgery. It's a modern set of protocols designed to reduce the stress of surgery and, crucially, get people discharged sooner.
And the spirometer is basically a ticket home.
In many ways, yes. Postoperative pulmonary complications like pneumonia are one of the main reasons patients get stuck in the hospital days longer than planned.
Right.
By standardizing the use of this device, hospitals can significantly reduce those stuck days.
It's interesting how everything connects. The pain leads to shallow breathing leads to atelectasis leads to pneumonia, and pneumonia keeps you in the hospital. The spirometer is the wedge that breaks that chain.
Exactly. It completely disrupts the cycle of decline.
I noticed the notes also touched on hygiene, which, frankly, I hadn't thought about, but you're breathing warm, moist air into a plastic tube for days.
That's a very valid concern.
Yeah.
The tube becomes a highly humid environment, which bacteria absolutely love.
Yeah.
These are strictly single-patient devices. You do not share your spirometer.
And when you go home?
Usually, you take it with you to continue the therapy, or it just gets thrown away. We prefer disposable units in hospitals to completely eliminate the risk of cross-contamination. You really don't want to be inheriting someone else's lung flora.
Definitely not. There was one final insight in the source material that I found really compelling. It described this barometer as an early warning system.
This is huge for the nursing staff. Because the volume-oriented units give you that hard number, the number becomes a vital sign.
Like blood pressure or temperature.
Exactly. Let's say a patient has been hitting 1,500 mLs consistently. Then suddenly, on a Tuesday afternoon, they can't get past 1,000, and they're struggling.
Okay.
That drop in capacity is often the very first indicator that something is wrong.
It shows up before the fever, before the x-ray looks bad.
Often, yes.
Yeah.
It tells us that atelectasis is worsening, or maybe fluid is building up, or perhaps the pain control is just wearing off. It gives the clinical team a heads up to intervene before it becomes a full-blown crisis.
That transforms the device from just a therapy tool into a diagnostic tool.
It connects the dots, and perhaps most importantly, it empowers the patient. It entirely shifts the dynamic.
I love that aspect of it, because so much of being a patient is entirely passive. You lie there, people poke you, people scan you, people give you pills. It's all done to you.
But the incentive spirometer, that is done by you. It says to the patient, you are a participant in your own rescue.
Participating in your own rescue, that is a powerful framing.
It gives you agency. Every time you pick up that tube and float that ball or raise that piston, you are actively deciding to fight for your recovery. You are taking ownership of your lung health.
It really changes the way you look at the object. It's not just a plastic toy. It's a tool for agency.
It is.
You know, it makes me think about how much of modern medicine is invisible to the patient. We have robotic surgery where the surgeon is across the room. We have medications working at a molecular level that you can't see or feel. But this is tactile.
It is tactile, and it's highly mechanical.
Yeah.
It reminds us that despite all the advanced biochemistry, the body is still a machine.
Yeah.
It uses pressure, flow, and volume. And sometimes you just have to do the maintenance work.
The maintenance work. I like that. So let's wrap this up with a bit of a summary for anyone listening who might be facing a surgery soon or who knows someone who is. What are the key takeaways from all this?
First, understanding the why. You aren't doing it to annoy the nurses. You are doing it to reinflate collapsed air sacs that are actively trying to stick shut. You are preventing pneumonia.
Second, the technique.
Right. Don't blow. Inhale. And do it slow and steady. Don't gasp. You want that laminar flow to reach the very bottom of the lungs.
And the hold.
Yes. Don't forget the hold. That 3 to 5 second pause at the top is where the stabilization happens.
And finally, the consistency.
It's a volume game. 10 times an hour. Treat it like a job. The more consistent you are, the faster you get back to baseline and the sooner you get to go home.
And don't be afraid to ask for pain management so you can actually do the job.
Crucial point. Don't be a hero with the pain. Be a hero with the breathing.
It's a reminder that we aren't just mechanics fixing a machine. We're dealing with people who need to feel like they have control over what's happening to them.
Absolutely. In an era where we have robotic surgery and AI diagnostics and genomic medicine, sometimes the most effective solution is a piece of plastic that just reminds us to take a deep breath.
And hold it.
And hold it.
So the next time you see one of those things sitting on a hospital tray, you won't look at it as a piece of junk. You'll see it as a personal lung gym.
A lung gym that keeps the lights on in your alveoli.
I like that. Keeping the lights on. It's a provocative thought to leave you with. That in our search for high-tech cures, the simple act of breathing deeply, when measured and disciplined, is still one of the most powerful medicines we have.
I couldn't agree more. Keep breathing, everyone.
That's all for this deep dive. Thanks for listening.